I assume that you're all here because you have dealt with, at some level or another, milk supply problems, primary failure, mystery problems, the enigma, the ones that we can't figure out, and I've been in the same boat with you. We're going to do just a really quick overview of mammogenesis and lactogenesis. I want to just lay a little bit of a foundation so that when we get into some of the endocrinology, your mind can jump with mine a little bit. And I would just encourage you guys all to move up as much as you want to. I think it's kind of hard to see way back there, but it's up to you. So first of all, the mammary gland undergoes three major phases of growth and development before pregnancy. You have in utero, then you have during the first 2 years of life, and then during puberty. During puberty, the estrogen stimulates the ductal growth, and the progesterone stimulates the growth of the alveoli. But the full differentiation of the gland requires several other things to happen. You need insulin, which stimulates the stem cells to proliferate. You need cortisol, which assists in the formation of the alveoli. Thyroxine stimulates the pituitary. And prolactin and growth hormone, they are integral to the alveolar development, which is the development of the milk-making cells. And then prolactin is also necessary for the development of estrogen receptors. And I have that in italics because that was a new aha for me. One of the interesting things that I've learned is that some of these hormones will actually impact the development of other hormones or their receptors. So to be missing one particular hormone, you can have a problem with receptors. How many of you have ever studied endocrinology? A little bit? Okay, and you have hormones, but in order to have hormones to work, you also have to have receptors. They're like locks and keys. So you can have tons of hormones circulating, but no receptors in what we call target organs, wherever it's supposed to, whatever organ it's supposed to work on, then you can have a hormone that does nothing. So the development of receptors along with proper level of hormone is an important thing. So during pregnancy, you have estrogen, progesterone, prolactin, and the human placental lactogen, which help to complete the breast growth, as may growth hormone via the IGF-1, the insulin growth-like factor 1. It's really interesting. You read different articles, and everybody kind of concentrate on a different thing, and really the way they phrase these things is, you know, this may help to do this, and this may help to do that, but I think it's important to know that they think that all of these play a role in there. What we don't know is that how important some are compared to others. Now, Cox found that the changes in breast volume during pregnancy were positively related to the concentration of human placental lactogen. Now, we have mostly concentrated on progesterone developing the alveoli and prolactin. So this is kind of a whole new thing with the human placental lactogen. Now, he's finding a bigger relationship between that growth with that hormone than with the other ones. So the sources of the mammary stimulating hormones, all the ones that are stimulating that growth, are going to be the pituitary, which gives us the growth hormone, prolactin, and thyroid stimulating hormone. You have the ovary, gives us estrogen, progesterone. The placenta gives us human placental lactogen and chorionic gonadotropin. The pancreas gives us insulin. And then there are also hormones that are synthesized locally within the breast by what they call paracrine activity. Those are influencing cells adjacent to them. And that includes, you have prolactin, progesterone, estrogen, relaxin, and epidermal growth factor. So not only do they have these other places that they may be produced, but also there is some production within the breast itself locally. So look how many systems we have that are sources of these mammary stimulating hormones. It's not like just the pituitary, you know, fix the pituitary, everything works. Lots of different sources, which gives you layers of complexity of interrelationships and how things can work. Got that picture so far? Starts getting deep really fast. So just a quick timetable for the development of alveoli. During puberty, you don't have a lot, but as your progesterone, placental lactogen, and prolactin really begin to kick in, the alveoli really begin to increase a large amount during pregnancy. As you can see, it really peaks around the time of birth. And then you go along here during lactation. And then as you go through the involution, as baby begins to wean, begins to cut back, then the alveoli also cut back. They also decrease. Now, this is my own little thought process and how these things work. It's the life cycle of breast development. And I kind of like to analogize it to a tree. A tree in winter, but I want to say a tree in winter. Actually, this one's got a few leaves, which is exactly what I wanted. In Santa Maria, we don't have a real winter. We don't have the winters like they have back east or in the Midwest. Our trees shed some leaves, but you still have some leaves left. And that's kind of how the breast is during a non-lactating state. It's there. You have alveoli there, but you don't have a lot. You just kind of have the basic system there, a few things. Once pregnancy occurs, you begin to leaf out like in spring. Okay, so things begin to really grow and blossom. And then, of course, once the baby's delivered, then the fruit, the milk, really begins to flow. And look how beautiful and big and full that tree is. And then, of course, during, as just like that last chart we saw, as you get to autumn, you get to involution and weeding, the tree, the leaves begin to fall off the tree, and it returns back to this state again. So this is sort of what's supposed to be happening during your pregnancy and going through that whole stage of lactation and coming around to the other side. Now, just a different way of looking at this. This is a slide of a mouse mammary gland, and you can see the virgin who has never had a pregnancy. You can see the branches and a few leaves here and there. Can you kind of see that same thing? Pregnancy, you begin to see the alveoli really begin to multiply. Lactation, look how full and dense that is. Very, very dense. And then involution, it's like you're going through the fall again, it's falling back off. Can you see that same idea rolling through there? So with lactogenesis, the progesterone actually interferes with prolactin at the alveolar prolactin receptor level. And what that means is that we know that prolactin levels are high, okay, during pregnancy, but what inhibits milk from flowing is that the progesterone's interfering with the receptors. It's getting in the way there. Okay, progesterone and pharmacologic amounts of androgens reduce the prolactin binding. So that's what's happening. They reduce its ability to bind. And this is a quote, maintenance of steroidal inhibition are effective in preventing postpartum milk synthesis and secretion. So lactogenesis 2 then begins at parturition as the placenta is delivered. And usually it's apparent within about 2 to 4 days on average. That's when, and I say apparent, that's when most women say, yep, my milk came in. So the hormones that are necessary to begin lactation, Hurley calls this a lactogenic complex. Prolactin, which is needed for lactose synthesis. Insulin, which is also needed for lactose synthesis and the maintenance and survival of the lactocytes during lactation. And cortisol, low levels which cause more alpha-lactalbumin to be made for lactose synthesis. And note, cortisol, where do you know that hormone from? It's a stress hormone. You need low levels. High levels are inhibitory, but low levels are necessary. Lactose synthesis is the key to milk secretion. No lactose synthesis, no milk. That is just the major component of what's happening. So another way of looking at milk synthesis, it's kind of like a long recipe with lots of different steps. If you've ever made a cake and you leave out the baking powder or you leave out the sugar, leave out one important ingredient and it flops. It's awful. Either it tastes horrible or it doesn't rise or it does something like that. It looks like brownies. And really the whole process of milk synthesis, you can kind of picture it the same way. You've got things that have to happen in order. Progesterone coming in here for the milk protein gene expression. You've got milk protein synthesis. You've got the whole process of lactose synthesis here. Imagine if we're missing something out of here, and then it goes to the next step, and you're missing that thing. What's going to happen? What are we going to get? Have you ever heard women say, well, my milk was just really thin and it was never anything else? I used to think that was just the foremilk, and they didn't know what they were talking about. But I have heard women with low milk supply or very little milk supply, and they talk about the composition of their milk. And even as I've talked with Peter Hartman, we've talked about the need probably to go back with these mothers and take samples of their milk and analyze it and see what may be missing from that. That's a step that needs to happen. So let's work on understanding true lactation failure. And I like to divide it, this is my way of doing it, dividing it into three major categories. The first is just delayed lactogenesis, which means it's a temporary situation. Your milk is coming in, but something is making the process slow. Secondary supply failure, which is generally caused by an outside force. So that's going to be management issues, things like that. And then there's primary supply failure, which refers to the problems that are specific to the mother's body. And at this point for us, they're most often irremediable, meaning most of the time we're having great difficulty figuring out how to fix it if it's something wrong inside the mom's body. Just a few causes of primary failure. You can have mechanical interference, such as breast surgeries and biopsies, and especially periareolar incisions. So if we're cutting ducts, milk can't get out. If we're cutting nerves, we can't get the message back and forth to the brain. Those are mechanical types of issues. A breast reduction surgery, you're taking out a good portion of the glandular tissue, and you're also interfering with nerves and things like that, so you have the same issues. They're mechanical. Breast augmentation, implants, and even though we know a lot of women do breastfeed successfully with implants, we also know that there are women who have difficulty, especially if they're pretty close to the surgery date, they've gotten pregnant close after, or that periareolar incision, again, different things like that, complications of the surgery, infections, all those things can cause problems. Blunt trauma. If a woman as a young girl has been in an accident and had chest trauma, that can actually impact the development of her breast. And maybe she even has one side that can be damaged and it doesn't develop properly. Radiation therapy for cancer. Most women who've had cancer, if they've had one breast radiated and the other one not, they'll find that the radiated breast does not give very much milk. And then a question mark here. Jan Barger and I have talked about this from time to time, and there's a question mark if abscesses or severe mastitis can cause damage that doesn't regrow. And now I'm thinking about, I have a fruit tree, since we're on that tree analogy, in my backyard. I love my apricot tree, but it's got something called fire blight. And every year, one or two branches just turn black, and everything just withers, and it can never regrow. And so I sometimes wonder, is it possible to have something that is damaged to the degree that it no longer responds to the hormones, the hormone cycle of pregnancy? That's a question mark. But, you know, Jan has seen at least one case where she's wondered, is that what happened because this breast used to work and now it's not reacting anymore? Now, with endocrine disturbances, this is another cause of primary failure. Retained placental fragments, I think most of us are familiar with this, the high progesterone that suppresses the prolactin efficacy. So when you have that, and that's more of a temporary thing, hopefully we'll find that. Really, I put that both under primary and I put that under delayed because it's a delay and hopefully we catch it in time. Hypopituitarism, if you have insufficient stimulation of lactation hormones. The pituitary has a lot of effect over our lactation hormones, so if it's not working properly, it's not producing, it's not releasing, that's going to have a major mess up with the rest of the system. Hemorrhage, or Sheehan's, and you can have insults and you can have infarctions, and the insult is sort of a partial situation where some of the pituitary is damaged but still functioning. You can have also something closer to necrosis, almost the death of the organ, which is very severe, and that's usually what has been constituted as Sheehan syndrome. There's a continuum there, though, and that's something that sometimes I don't think we realize, that you can have a degree of a problem and not necessarily all the way to the far end. But that's another form of a hormone disturbance. And then uncontrolled diabetes. We know that the breast is a sensitive target organ for insulin, and that insulin is necessary for lactogenesis and breast growth. There was a interesting situation that I heard about where women who are diabetic were running out of places to inject their insulin, and so they started injecting it into their breasts. And there was an interesting, curious side effect, breast growth, when they started putting it straight in there. Kind of gives some credence to this idea, doesn't it? Diabetic women also tend to have lower levels of prolactin. The the parathyroid hormone, placental lactogen during pregnancy and postpartum. So their levels are just lower than they should be altogether. So you've got different things that can be happening with them. And when I say uncontrolled diabetes, I'm really talking about type 1. Type 1 is the one that's usually the issue. With hypothyroidism, this is a whole other issue, and I'm still struggling to get my brain around it because I keep seeing conflicting things, conflicting experiences coming up. One article said reproductive failure, infertility, pregnancy wastage, failure of lactation occurred in 37% of hypothyroid and 36% of, look at this, hyperthyroid cases. I'm going, and then again, 16% in the euthyroid, that's people who have normal thyroid levels, and 16% of healthy controls. Euthyroid means they've been corrected. Now, this is an important thing also because they're saying reproductive failure, failure of lactation. So when they see hypothyroid, they see lots of, you know, a third of the women having problems. Look at the hyperthyroid too. I'm going, even hyperthyroid, they're seeing these problems. The women who are corrected are better off, but they're not all fixed, are they?
Corrected with
Hormone replacement, thyroid replacement, yes. So they're better off. They're not a third, but they're still at almost a fifth. And then, you know, compared to the healthy controls who have no problems. So, pardon?
Oh, I'm not thyroid problems. So I'm the definitions of what
Yes. Ross was talking about the definitions of hyper, yes, I have some articles, a few key articles I brought with me on diagnosing hypothyroidism, and oh my goodness, it's extremely complex and can be very subtle. There's a lot more to this, and we'll touch on it more a little bit later. Miyake in 1989, he said, you know, insufficient stimulation of hormones, sometimes even when thyroid due to treatment, we would have problems with milk supply. So he's saying the same thing that Joshi is showing up here too. High testosterone is a whole other issue that can come up for causes of endocrine disturbances. Testosterone downregulates prolactin and estrogen receptors. Okay, so the receptors is the important key word. Downregulates. I can't give you a precise definition of that. It sounds like there are fewer in number as opposed to an interference. There's different problems you can have with receptors. But one way or the other, we do not have the same receptor response to the hormones. The hormones there, but the receptors are not. So then we have this question mark, this thing that we call insufficient mammary tissue, which has kind of been its own category, at least for me on the forum. And there's a question, is it genetic or is it hormonal? How many people believe it's genetic? How many people believe it's hormonal? How many people don't want to commit? That's what I thought. Okay. I started off here believing that it was genetic, and I am shifting over to the hormonal, and the truth probably lies somewhere in between. There are some things that seem to run in families, but is it a hormonal problem that is running in families and not necessarily the inability to grow breasts per se? So let's look a little bit about the observations in the literature. I love this. Back in 1957, Harold Waller had this book on breastfeeding. And this is a really fascinating picture. These are both postmortem pictures of women who are not too far after birth. And you can see that overall the breast size is fairly close. You can see a difference in the shape, though, can't you? You notice the difference? And he comments, the left one, he says, almost the whole gland is filled with alveolar tissue with very little fat or fiber. So this dark area is the gland, and the light area is the fat and fiber. On the right one, he says, the secreting tissue is limited to a thin streak along the base of the gland. There is a large central mass of fibrous tissue and much fat. And he comments, the development of a large duct system further suggests hormonal dysfunction. So back here in 1957, somebody was running around saying, gee, I think that there could be some hormonal problems involved. What I think is really key is from the outside, you might not think these two breasts were that different. They look to be almost the same cup size, although the shape is a lot different. But look at the difference of what's inside the breast. Okay? Hold on to that thought.
Which one is more milk?
Which one is more milk? The one with the dense tissue, the one that was on the left. Let me go back. This one has all the secreting tissue. This one only had it here. Okay? Yeah, the milk is being made in the dark areas. It's not being made there. So Marianne Neifert, most of you probably know her name. If you don't, you'll get to know it well. She had probably done a lot of the work in popularized, because there has not been a lot written on insufficient milk supply. And in fact, when I started my thesis and I did my literature search, it's just like almost there's almost nothing there. Now, I know that there are probably things scattered in the literature, but very, very difficult to dig out. But Marianne's one of the names that we know. Back in 1985, she did a case study of three women. This is her first article with lactation failure. And she found common factors of absence of typical breast changes during pregnancy, the failure of postpartum breast engorgement, and at least one abnormal breast, including less density of tissue. Okay, less density of tissue has to do with what we just saw. Okay, light will pass through the fat. It does not pass through the glandular tissue. And she used light scanning. You ever gone into the bathroom and put a flashlight on your hand, turn off the light to see your bones through your hand? You used to do that as a kid? Try it with your breast. I think after, were you there when we did this at the Lactation Institute? I think you were there. We all went into the bathroom and you were lactating and we had our flashlights and we were doing this. It's kind of funny, kind of cute, but you know, actually it's a very non-invasive technique, and I would love to see this developed more for our use to be able to diagnose some of these things with moms. In 1990, she did a prospective study of 319 primips. The breast exams were performed in the last trimester, and then the mothers were followed for outcome. The risk factors that she found in that particular group, she found periareolar breast incisions, and that's pretty obvious. That's, again, that cut around the areolar margin, which is going to interfere with the nerves. Minimal prenatal breast enlargement, so they're not reporting much growth during the pregnancy, and minimal postpartum breast engorgement, which to me says the milk didn't really come in, nothing really changed afterwards. So those were her risk factors, looking at just a general population of women coming through the hospital. Now, how many of you are familiar with this study by Huggins, Petock, and Merrillis? This is excellent. This is excellent and worth running out and getting. They enrolled women who had questionable-looking breasts. So this is a different population. Now, Marianne's population was a general one, okay? Now, this one, they enrolled women who had questionable-looking breasts that are coming in during labor. They categorized them by four types, and then they followed them for breastfeeding outcome. So if they thought that their breasts looked suspicious based on their clinical experience, those were the ones they enrolled, and they wanted to say, of these weird breasts, how many of them didn't work well, and what are the common factors? Their major risk factors that they found were an intramammary distance of greater than 1.5 inches, and that's a space here between your breasts where it's flat and bony, where there's no breast tissue. Now, for me, that's about a fingertip. They're finding that if it was greater than 1.5 inches, that was a risk factor for poor milk supply. Hypoplasia types 2 to 4, I'll show you that in a minute. Hypoplasia means underdevelopment. And then also, this is a curious one, stretch marks. Now, what do we usually associate stretch marks with? Growth. But they found unusual amounts of stretch marks in women who reported very little growth. Didn't have an explanation for it, but it was something that they noted as a curiosity. Here are the breast types that they developed, and I love that they did this. It's really helpful. So type 1 is a normal breast. You see the normal fullness all the way around. You see a small space between the breasts. With type 2, you're beginning to lose some of that space. You notice that the breasts are further apart because you don't have as much development of the breast tissue in here. In type 3, you're losing not only the inside breast, but you're losing the outside breast. And notice that the proportion of the areola to the breast, the areola is much larger in proportion. As these types become more severe, the proportion of the areola becomes much more out than it should be. So when you get type 4, where you have nothing at all, all you have is what they call a constricted cone base. There's nothing up here, nothing on the sides either. So you almost have what some people call dog ears. Big, you know, just as, and most of what you would call a breast tissue is areola. Were you asking, did you raise a hand or? Okay. So here's a picture of a mom who has lots and lots and lots of stretch marks. This mom had minimal development during this pregnancy. She was not a severe case. In fact, you could almost put her type 1 to 2. She doesn't look bad. She had partial supply, but she just had an unusual unusual amount of stretch marks. 7 o'clock and my tongue doesn't want to work. Now, Marmet and Shell kind of looked at things a little differently in their book, Lactation Forms. They have these first 5 breasts that you'll see, and this first one is a normal, saggy breast. The second one is what I call the Playboy breast, a nice, perky one. And these are really constitute most of what I would consider to be normal breasts. This third one is more of a cone-shaped. And it's a little more prepubescent, if you can see that. This one's a real rounded, unusual shape. You don't see that too often. And this one is very prepubescent. It's just beginning to bud out. It's your 10, 11, 12-year-old. These last two, Shelley and I added. And this one is what I would call an udder-shaped breast. And this other one is a tubular-shaped breast with that very constricted cone base. This is what I would consider, if you've ever seen the classic, what we call asymmetrical insufficient mammary tissue. So one side is grossly different from the other, and when we see this presentation, most of us are going, okay, this isn't going to probably work. And when I used to hear, you know, insufficient mammary tissue, I was looking for this classic presentation. Now, I've been greatly expanded since then and realizing there's this huge continuum, but this is really what got it all started. Here's a picture of tubular breasts. And look at the side, look at the areola compared to the breast tissue. And it almost takes on its own shape. It's almost like it's been kind of glued onto the breast. Can you get that feel of it? Okay, and that was an impaired milk supply there. Now, this is a mom that was in my practice. It's been a little over a year now. And this was a really unusual situation for me because she came to me originally. The phone call was severe engorgement. She had come out of the hospital. They had been pumping there, but she went home with nothing and couldn't get the baby to take the milk out, could get nothing out. So she showed up on my doorstep about 11 o'clock at night, and I went to work on her. Despite all of my best efforts, I got very little out of her. But what really surprised me, and this picture does not do justice, is that she had one very udder-shaped breast and one tubular-shaped breast, but they were engorged. And in my mind, this asymmetrical thing and engorgement did not go together, did not go together. But what's interesting, I think, is the fact that we could not get that milk really flowing. You know, so she had a presentation that didn't seem like it should work, yet there it was full, so you're going, it should work, right? And yet there was still something that wasn't right, because that milk, and as long as we worked, it took a couple of days for this to begin to flow and to resolve, and then we ended up with a poor supply that we constantly had to work to bring back up. I almost had this picture, because it was very naughty, of tangles inside. I almost had that sensation of these tangly kind of breasts. Can you imagine milk being trapped back in here, but something not being developed properly? And so it's being just all trapped all over the place and not flowing out well. Of course, what happens if it doesn't flow out well? What does the body do? It begins to cut down. Exactly. So that was just a very unique presentation, something I never thought I would see. Let's see if this next picture. And this is the same woman, and from this angle, look at the size of her areola. Now, interestingly enough, her little guy had this bubble palate, and this was a beautiful fit. This bulbous areola fit with that bubble palate perfectly, and they actually were a very good match. Other correlations to primary failure. Obesity is probably the big one that's been hitting the news the last year or so. Hilson and Rasmussen, and I don't know how to pronounce that last one, have done several works on these. Here are just some quotes from their studies I found very interesting. Excessive fatness in the reproductive period may inhibit lactation performance in women. Now, this is a real brand new thought, because they're saying that a woman who was not excessively fat before she got pregnant, but during the pregnancy period developed excessive fatness, that could be a risk factor for lactation performance. Then here you see obese rats that initiate lactation less successfully. They produce less milk than controls. They have a higher concentration of fat, but lower concentration of, what's that word there? lactose and protein in their milk than do the non-obese rats. Studies in obese rats show that these animals remain hyperinsulinemic during transition from pregnancy to lactation. I want you to hold on to that thought also, which may inhibit the delivery of nutrients to the mammary gland for milk biosynthesis. So this was their theory, that perhaps it was a hyperinsulinemia situation which would prevent nutrients from being delivered. And of course, you know, like a recipe, if you don't have all your ingredients, you can't make a cake, right? Finally, an additional commentary. They're talking about fat as a source for progesterone, so obese women continue to produce progesterone after the placenta is removed. And what happens with progesterone? What does it do during pregnancy? It's inhibiting the milk supply. So they're saying obese women have more progesterone, and they're wondering maybe that's the problem. Maybe that's part of the inhibition of the milk supply. Their comment was it can take them longer to develop a milk supply. So they saw that not necessarily as a permanent problem, but almost like a delayed lactogenesis type of issue. I suspect that it probably the truth is all over the map. There are probably severe ones. There are probably ones that develop okay. Hypertension, Marianne Neifert mentioned this in Dr. Mom. It was her observation from her studies. But what I think is interesting, and I think I forgot to stick in here, is there's also a new article in the Journal of Pediatrics from last November, and one of the risk factors that they found for cessation of lactation in the first 7 to 10 days of life was hypertension. And I asked them, well, what about the drugs? Because some people are saying, you know, they see the hypertension drugs causing problems, but they teased that out. They already looked for that, and they said it was the hypertension in specific. So we don't know exactly how that would work, but that is a risk factor for having problems. Now, this was one that intrigued me a lot. You know, we talk about insulin resistance. Well, there's something called, something called prolactin resistance. And Zarger in 2000 had a case, a mom who's a mother of three times insufficient milk. He did tests on her. She had normal prolactin secretion, normal reserves, normal mammary tissue development. Have you had one of these before? Everything looked normal. Everything looked clean. The whole case history looked clean. And so their theory was maybe it was resistance to prolactin. Now, that kind of goes along that receptor issue again. Okay, whatever would be the resistance. But I was intrigued with that idea as opposed to not having enough tissue, not having enough milk-making tissue, but maybe there was some resistance going on that didn't allow the whole process to complete. What in the world? I don't know how we just did that. Any comments while we're getting this reset? She's asking about insulin resistance and would it fit into uncontrolled diabetes. So far, we've not seen any direct correlations between that. Type 2 diabetes, which is where insulin resistance comes in, and type 1 seem to be different animals. Type 1 is where we had the clear-cut problems, and there's been no associations made with type 2 so far. Okay, I can't hear you.
I saw the connection somewhere else there.
Okay, she's saying with type 2 diabetes you may have issues of obesity. Yes. 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 And I have to say, yes, you're beginning to see the circle and the web that's going on. You've got more than one thing happening. Type 2 diabetics, they're not always obese, but they more often have obesity problems, yes. And then that brings in all those other possible issues. Go ahead.
What about not making it to term? Preterm babies and the difference in how things are made.
Hang on, I'm sorry. Let's see.
What was it called?
26? Go up to 26. 27? 27. Okay. Go there, baby. All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
What happens when they deliver prematurely so they never make it to the third trimester?
Okay, she's asking about women who deliver prematurely. Hold on to that. I want you to hold on to that because we're going to be going through some stuff that's going to kind of fit into there. Okay, so clues from induced lactation. I began giving some thought to this because, you know, how many of you have read the reports that I have about the woman, you know, off in the jungle who, you know, died and grandpa bit the baby to breast and got milk supply, and, you know, other women take somebody else's baby and start breastfeeding it and the milk comes in. And yet, is that our experience here? Certainly not in the United States, and I don't know in any developed countries you really don't hear about these kinds of good experiences happening. Yet traditional cultures seem to have this expectation. Ross says, yes, she's seen it. Really, really easily? Because it's been pretty rare, I think, in our culture. Ooh. She's talking about Muslim countries. Well, I would love to hear more about that afterwards, because there's not enough. But just generally speaking, when I started thinking, at least in the U.S., our, you know, full supplies are rare for our induced lactation, our adoptive lactation. Our adoptive moms are also infertility patients for the most part. You know, there are a few that adopt for other reasons, but I would say that that's probably the largest part of our population. And I started wondering, could that have something to do with our relative lack of success here, and are these things related? And then what ties into that, and where my thesis came into the picture, is that PCOS, which stands for polycystic ovary syndrome, is considered the leading cause of infertility. What got me all into this, I had two moms who presented back-to-back. In the first case, it was an obese mom. She was in her mid-20s. She presented with her second child, who was failure to thrive. Her first baby was a crisis pregnancy, and when she was a teen, and she didn't end up succeeding to breastfeed. She had some milk supply problems that she figured she just didn't know what she was doing, but here she had baby number two. She had had some secondary infertility, but she finally had her second baby. She wanted to get it right. She wanted to succeed. Highly motivated mom, did all of her education, and as I began to do a case history, I just started digging further into her health history. I discovered that she had been diagnosed with Stein-Leventhal syndrome. Just the next week, I had a second mom who came in. She was moderately overweight. She presented with her third baby, who was also failure to thrive at 3 weeks of age. This mom described a history of infertility and milk supply problems, but she also really wanted to breastfeed this baby. And it's interesting. Both of these women just figured they were young, stupid, didn't know what they were doing, hadn't tried hard enough, but they, you know, here they were. They wanted to get this right. As we dug into her history, I discovered that she had been diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome. So I was very intrigued with this, and I went off to the internet after she left, and as I began to do research, I discovered that these were the same syndromes, different names, same syndrome. So that started getting my mind going. You can imagine the wheels that would go. So first of all, let's ask the question, what is polycystic ovary syndrome, also known as Stein-Leventhal syndrome? It is the leading cause of infertility in women. The prevalence, it affects 4 to 15% of all women. Okay, out of 100, that's between 4 and 15 women. That is a lot of women. As we were driving up here, Nancy Williams and I drove up together, and we were kind of rehearsing for each other the different moms we've worked with in the last couple of months, and I was amazed. She probably had 4, 5, 6 moms that she's had dealt with and have had PCOS. It is a disturbance of the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis, and that refers to the relationship between the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the ovaries, how they interact reproductively. Some people also consider it a disorder of carbohydrate metabolism. It's real interesting that diets such as the Atkins diet seems to make a difference. When they take out the carbohydrates, things seem to work better. It may also represent a number of disorders. It is a syndrome. It is not a disease. There are some old articles that call it PCOD, but it is not a disease because it does not have a specific set of criteria, A, B, C, D, and you've got it, chickenpox. It is a collection. Okay, it's a syndrome. Possible endocrine imbalances include elevated androgens, elevated estrogen, elevated cholesterol, low progesterone. Okay, so we can see that you want to key in on the low progesterone, elevated LHFSH ratio, Insulin resistance is very common to PCOS, hyperinsulinemia, and really hyperinsulinemia is compensatory to insulin resistance. When your body is resisting insulin, it starts compensating by making more and more and more, so you have lots of insulin. Low sex-binding globulin hormone, low thyroid. There's also a question mark on hyperprolactinemia. Some authors believe it can be included in this syndrome, and other authors say if it exists, they exclude PCOS, so it depends on who you're listening to. But these are all the possible endocrine imbalances.
I was asked to take the fasting-free plasma insulin test.
Okay.
I know that I was high in that, and where does...
That's gonna relate to insulin resistance, I believe. I'm not real good on those tests, though. Possible clinical symptoms, this will be easier for all of us to kind of grab onto. Polycystic ovaries, hirsutism, which refers to inappropriate body hair, mustaches, beards, nipple hair, things like that. Adult acne should go away after you're a teenager. Male pattern balding. Acanthosis nigricans are dark brown velvety patches on the nape of the neck or the inside of the arms and the axilla. Skin tags. I was real intrigued to discover skin tags. Skin tags are supposed to be a sign of insulin resistance. I developed them during my pregnancies, and I had gestational diabetes. I still have them. Central obesity, which is putting all the fat on in the center, you know, not the hips, but the abdomen. Oligo or amenorrhea means erratic or no menstrual cycles. Infertility, of course, is going to be a result if you're not cycling. History of miscarriages, gestational diabetes, pregnancy, hypertension, underline that word there, preeclampsia, history of heavy menstrual bleeding. So you can go from one extreme to the other, erratic menstrual cycles, and then you can have these very, very heavy, bad bleeds. And then I put a question mark on it, but it's beginning to be mentioned in the official literature now. They see depression often with these women. And I heard a... I heard a comment that was made by a particular physician who said, you know, if you're fat and you can't get pregnant, you'd be depressed too. It really goes beyond that, I promise you. I have been hanging out on a listserv for PCOS women for about 3 years now. You listen to them talk, and it's really fascinating how many have dealt with depression, and you really get the sense that it's chemically related, especially when with certain medications or some of them just getting their carbohydrates in balance. They go on the Atkins diet, they get their, you know, get their carbohydrate down, and all of a sudden the depression lifts. It makes sense. Look at all the hormones that are all whacked out and think of all the chemistry going on in the brain. Surely there is the ability to influence brain chemistry and to cause depression beyond just, gee, I'm depressed because I'm having problems with my body. And this is something that I pay a lot of attention to.
Well, just the hormones alone,
just
on our period.
Yeah, she said just a hormone, yeah, PMS and all that. Uh-huh. Yeah, take that, multiply it by 10.
I would wonder what's going on with that.
What?
I would wonder what's going on with oxytocin.
She wants to know what's going on in oxytocin. Yes, that is a whole nother ball of wax I'm dying to open up. I've been digging things up, and that's... What? I am. I'm signed up. I'll be there. Okay, this is just a really quick picture of the Farabin-Galway assessment model for hirsutism. If you were not sure, there's the degrees of severity, and there's seven sites are shown, but there's actually 9 key sites, and as you can see, a score of 8 or more indicates the presence of androgen excess. It's the male hormone androgens, testosterone, are what cause that excessive body hair. So as far as diagnosis, as I already explained, this is a syndrome. And there is a lot of confusion as to how we're going to diagnose it. The International Classification of Diseases says if you have clinical hirsutism, that's that body hair, plus oligomenorrhea, which is your erratic cycles, they would say, okay, you have that, you've got PCOS. The National Institute of Health says if you have menstrual irregularity plus the evidence of hyperandrogenism, which can either be the acne or the hirsutism, plus no other illness. Carmina and Lobo describe what they call a mild form, which can be hyperandrogenism plus polycystic ovaries. Now, notice these other two didn't say polycystic ovaries. In the beginning, they said you had to have it. They no longer say you have to have polycystic ovaries. They have polycystic ovary syndrome. Key point. Point. And then Charles Gluck, a researcher that I've been doing a lot of dialoguing with from Cincinnati, Ohio, this is his criteria, and it's sort of a three-point. You can either multiple ovarian cysts, so he says you got the ovarian cyst, you know, he'll give you the diagnosis, or if you have fasting hyperinsulinemia, which is that test you were talking about, plus high serum testosterone, or fasting hyperinsulinemia plus oligo or amenorrhea. So he's got three different ways of saying, yes, you probably have it. Do you see how kind of confusing it gets? When we talk about women coming in and saying they're diagnosed or they're not diagnosed, many doctors don't even bother with the formality of a diagnosis because it's so ambiguous. You know, some of them do, and they'll give you a label, and then you can go and run with it. But other doctors just say, you know, you're having problems with your cycle, and let's just give you some birth control pills, and they kind of skip the label. And so you may be working with women who have this but have never been given a diagnosis.
And infertility is not on
me. Infertility is really the result. It's really the result of the other things going on. If you're not cycling, you're not ovulating, then you don't get pregnant.
Present with. Would you rule out PCOS if they had no fertility problems?
I would not automatically rule out PCOS if they had no fertility problems, but more often than not they do. I will just say that my observation, I've had two or three teenage moms who have come through my practice who've had milk supply problems, and they've had they've had irregular cycles, but you know, it's like when you're really young, you get pregnant easier. And like that first, my first case mom, she had she was a teenage mom with her first baby, got pregnant. And later on, she's 25, she wants to have another baby, she's having problems. So I've seen what I think is, I've seen a time period where it's probably starting to happen, but nobody's really pinpointed it yet. And that's a whole other topic we might get into. Let me hold, is it real fast?
No.
Okay, hang on to it and let's go. The diagnosis excludes congenital adrenal hyperplasia, Cushing syndrome, thyroid disease, hyperprolactinemia, depending on who you listen to, and androgen tumors, because all of these things can cause the same type of symptoms. Confounding factors, normal glycemic women can be insulin resistant, and non-hirsute women can be hyperandrogenic. When we talked about the obesity, 50% of the women are obese, but guess what? 50% of them are not. 50% of those women can be of normal lean stature. And especially among those women who are leaner, you don't always see all these obvious symptoms. And they're saying, so a woman who can have normal, she can be normal glycemic, yet she can have insulin resistance. So her insulin is not showing it yet. She can have no body hair, yet she can have too much androgen. So there's lots of confusion here, lots of confounding factors going along. What causes PCOS? Big question. There are multiple theories on the origin. There's been a question of fetal exposure to androgens. There was a study done in Scotland where they looked at this. I'm not going to go into detail because I think we're getting short on time. But they identified two groups of women. One was they were born to very heavy women, and the other, they had gestated extra long. And in both those groups, they postulated that the fetus was exposed to high levels of androgens, high levels of androgens in the obese woman, and high levels of androgens from late pregnancy, because your androgen levels rise throughout pregnancy, and so if you gestate extra long. And the question mark was raised, if you're exposed to lots of androgens too much, can that cause this whole thing to start? That was where they saw some correlations. Genetics, they've identified some genes. They've been working real hard on that, but there's definitely a familial component. It definitely runs in families. If you have PCOS, your sister has a 50% chance of having it. Something else that's real interesting, SGA infants. One of the things that they're finding, a small for gestational age infant is more likely to develop PCOS. There's actually a list of four or five things that they're more likely to develop, but PCOS is one of them. That seems to be a risk factor for developing it. And there are also other predisposing factors, trauma, blunt head trauma. I had one mom that she had normal menstrual history until she was in an accident, a car accident, and then all of a sudden her cycles became erratic and she developed PCO type of symptoms. Epileptic meds such as valproate in adolescence. And this is a real big one because you've got teens who are having seizures, you're treating them, but some of the medications such as this one can induce PCOS in them. So you're treating one thing and you're causing another. And then there's this question mark of lack of insulin in aim. A few years ago, there was an article that a Jewish doctor had discovered that there's insulin in human milk. And the question mark is, we don't put insulin in formula. And maybe insulin plays a special role of getting the body used to things, just like we know about cholesterol. There's high levels of cholesterol in milk, and you know they kind of get all freaked out about babies and high cholesterol, and yet maybe that is actually preparing the body to metabolize it correctly. So lots of different thoughts and ideas. Pardon?
AI.
AI, artificial infant milk formula. Sorry about that. So let's just take a look at how this works. You get a disturbance of the hypothalamus and the pituitary, and that leads to increased luteinizing hormone and decreasing follicle-stimulating hormone, which leads in turn to a hyperstimulation of the ovarian theca cells. And that causes increased androgens, which affects the follicle maturation in the ovaries. Which leads to, if you have problems with maturation, then you're getting menstrual irregularities, infertility, you're not ovulating properly. And then you've got adipose tissue converting androstenedione to estrone, which affects the gonadotropin-releasing hormone. This is kind of a picture. Did that drown you? Pretty technical. Okay, this will help a little bit. Here's the polycystic ovary. This is a normal ovary. And this is what the polycystic ovary looks like. It has what they call a string of pearls on it. These are those large, immature cells that just have developed and have never matured properly, and they just kind of collect along the ovary. And this is what that cycle looks like that I just wrote out to you. This is what it actually looks like as a picture. So if you want to start with the pituitary, you have the problems with the pituitary. There's that FH, LH, FSH production, which affects the ovaries, and that the ovaries start producing too much androgen. That causes problems with fat development. That causes problems with estrogen and gonadotropin-releasing hormone, and this one affects the hypothalamus and the pituitary. So see how you just get the cycle and it goes? Plus down here, the adrenal gland, if it's producing too much androgens, that can also feed into the cycle. Then there's a whole other entry point that's not even reflected in that picture, and that's hyperinsulinemia and the insulin resistance. So you have anything. You have genetic predisposition, aging, pregnancy, drugs, all these things that can cause insulin resistance, causing hyperinsulinemia, and then that can get you into that whole cycle also. The point of all this is none of us are going to get a real good handle on all of it. It gets very, very deep, and the literature is very, very technical. But just to kind of see the complexity and all the different directions that things can go. The possible long-term consequences of PCOS include type 2 diabetes. Usually the onset is age 30 to 40. Hypertension, heart disease. The hypertension, remember high cholesterol? That relates to hypertension and the heart disease. GYN cancers, especially endometrial cancer, so they're at high risk for these things. It is a major women's health issue. I got into it because of the breastfeeding. I've actually become very passionate about it because heart disease can lead to death, diabetes can lead to death, and so can cancers. It's not just about can I get pregnant, and it's not even about can I breastfeed, although that's very important to me. So how might PCOS affect milk supply? I'm going to give you, and there's going to be a pile of theories here because there's lots of possibilities and nothing has been truly nailed down yet. So I want you to engage your brain with me here. First of all, could it affect breast growth? The in utero exposure to androgens. Okay, remember this? And Spiroff, Leon Spiroff, who has a reproductive text, he says abnormalities in adult size or shape may reflect the impact of hormones, especially the presence or absence of testosterone, which is, you have problems with testosterone and PCOS during this early period. Isn't that interesting? Abnormalities in adult size or shape. So that's our weird breasts, our weird shaped breasts. might have been caused by testosterone, which could occur within PCOS, could it not? Inadequate estrogen or progesterone. Remember, the estrogen, you get high estrogen, but testosterone downregulates its receptors. And then you have progesterone. If you don't have enough progesterone during adolescence, what effect does that have on the development of the glandular tissue? What about inadequate or ineffective prolactin if it's being interfered with? Or what about the insulin during pregnancy? What if the whole concept of insulin resistance, we haven't pieced that together, but that's been a question mark in my mind. If you have insulin resistance, can you have it in the breast? And if the breast is a very sensitive target organ for insulin, it's not getting it all, can that affect our breast growth? There are supporting observations for the PCOS link in the literature. This was something that's interesting, too, because I dug and dug for a couple of years, and about year three, after not finding anything mentioning PCOS and breasts anywhere, I got into the pre-Medline stuff. I started following back footnotes and references and ordering articles, and then I was surprised at what I found all of a sudden. Irving Stein and Levenfall, the original describers of this syndrome, had observations in some of their articles. Look at this. They made comments about retarded breast development, scant breast development, small, pale, firm with prolonged amenorrhea, in many instances, hypoplasia of the breasts. You will not find anything in any of the recent literature the last 10 or 20 years. You will not see breasts mentioned anywhere with PCOS. But look, the original describers, we're talking about that. Anybody want to postulate why it isn't mentioned now? Yeah, because I think there's not been a lot of breastfeeding and nobody cares. They're not even thinking that direction. Mm-hmm. There was a soft tissue radiography study that was done. They looked at breast tissue. This was fascinating. They looked at breast tissue, the uterus of the women with PCOS, and they compared them to normal age-corrected women. They identified five distinct groups. So they're looking at the uteruses and the breasts to see if they could predict hormonal problems. So they're kind of working backwards. They found five groups. They noted that there could be hypoplasia of the gland, hypoplasia of the breast, or both. Now put your mind to that. Hypoplasia of the gland is that one picture where that breast, they had the fatty tissue in it. Okay, so the breast looked normal. Hypoplasia of the gland is what's inside. The breast looked normal on the outside, but what was on the inside there wasn't enough of. Hypoplasia of the breast is the other extreme where the whole breast is small. And then both. So the whole breast can be small, but it can still be filled with glandular tissue. And then they also found both. Now, isn't that interesting that they found in this group of women with PCOS all these abnormalities of breast presentations? And they comment, there's evidence of a marked decrease in the glandular parenchyma, even where large breasts with much fatty tissue simulate hypertrophy. To translate that, even you have the obese woman with a large breast, large pendulous breast, and you're saying, well, she doesn't have any problem with breast growth. She doesn't have any problem with, you know, breast tissue. There it is. They're saying, you can have those big breasts, and they look like there's a lot there, but simulates hypertrophy means it looks like a lot's there, but there's nothing inside. So you palpate those breasts, and what do they feel like? They're soft and squishy. You don't feel any of that rough glandular tissue. You're feeling the smooth fat, and you're feeling the fibers. So they're saying, here you've got hypoplasia on the one extreme and hyperplasia with nothing inside on the other extreme. Then there was a Brazilian study, and this is really just a mention in the literature, a paragraph from a conference. I would love to find the authors. I have not been successful so far. Anybody in Brazil with connections? I'd love to find this person. But they observed what I call it a tangled glandular tissue. And they said the breast tissue in the women with PCOS has presented gross disorders in a qualitative study of the lobular architecture. The intralobular and the interlobular connective tissue were hypertrophic and partially hyalinized. So they're saying the connective tissue was overgrown and hyalinization is almost like this protein coating. Just think of something almost crystallizing. But the bottom line is they're saying they had a lot of the wrong things developing inside the breast. You got a breast with different proportions than what you're supposed to find. Now another question mark then, what about postpartum hormonal interference? Okay, so one theory, high levels of androgens can downregulate the prolactin and estrogen receptors. This question mark is saying, well, what if we have normal breast tissue? It looks like normal breast tissue. Maybe we can have interference still. And so you've got the issue of the high androgen levels. And just one support for this idea, we do know that testosterone has been used in many past years for lactation suppression. And there's also a case study by Kay Hoover. How many of you have read her article on thecalutian cysts in JHL? This is another must read. Really fascinating. She had a mom who had developed what is called a thecalutian cyst. It's on the ovary. It was a pregnancy, during pregnancy only. And during the pregnancy, many of these women develop what's called signs of virilization, that very male look. Okay, they can get even things called clitoromegaly. Not all women are real obvious, but they have these very, very high testosterone levels during the pregnancy. It's not a dangerous condition. It's self-limiting. Once they deliver, the levels begin to come down. But in this particular case study, this woman's milk did not come in until the testosterone levels fell to a certain level. They had to get low enough before the milk started to come in. So again, that's another way that you could have normal breast tissue and yet still not have milk happening. Another theory for PCOS, insulin resistance may prevent the adequate glucose uptake in the alveoli. We were talking about that a little earlier. And then for support, diabetes is known to negatively impact milk production when it's not well controlled. And then remember Hurley and his lactogenic complex. Insulin is a very, very important role here, so resistance just logically seems like it might be able to interfere, does it not? And then we also had a rat study that noted problems with hyperinsulinemia after delivery, and they theorized that interference with the delivery of nutrients. We saw that earlier. And I'm going to whip through these a little fast. Another theory is, how about the progesterone drop? If your progesterone levels are inadequate, and remember many of these women miscarry, and it seems like one of the issues involved in these miscarriages is that the progesterone levels may not be high enough. These are the women that may be given progesterone supplementation for the first trimester or longer in order to sustain the pregnancy. So we're assuming the placenta takes over and they have enough progesterone, but I have a question mark there. Maybe it wasn't enough and the drop isn't enough to sensitize the alveoli. Another theory, could the PCOS induce hypertension, suppress lactation in certain women? These women tend to develop hypertension during pregnancy. So maybe we've got this hypertension connection with the milk supply problems. And we've got Marianne Neifert's observation of that. And then we've got that Journal of Pediatrics observation of the hypertension problem. So these things could arise. And who was it was asked talking about the premature baby situation? So these moms who have babies prematurely and they're having milk supply problems, well, is it related to the premature delivery or is it related to the health condition underlying the premature delivery? And that's a question mark I have, since these women have much more difficulty getting pregnant, holding on to the pregnancy, and carrying it to term. Okay, another theory, the hormonal imbalances might disrupt milk production by interfering with one or more links of the synthesis chain. And we know that you need lots of lactose. If you don't have enough lactose to draw the water out, you don't get volume. So if we're missing that element for lactose, then we're going to miss everything. Other constituents may be missing, resulting in thin, watery milk. And then there's the concomitant hypothyroidism, which may cause problems. And you can have secondary hypothyroidism. You can have subclinical hypothyroidism. I just had my eyes open to see how many layers there are to that that most likely could impact women that we have not explored at all. Most doctors only run one or two tests, and just in my reading of articles, you know, there are several different things that can be looked at, and there may be subtle things going on that we've just plain all missed, and so we all shrug our shoulders and nobody knows what the problem is. Montoro comments about hypothyroidism. A history of menstrual irregularity before pregnancy may be elicited, particularly menorrhagia, which is reported to occur frequently even in patients with mild hypothyroidism. Something that I've been intrigued with and I don't think it showed up on the list earlier is that a lot of these women with PCOS are also having hypothyroid problems. Now, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is it the hypothyroidism that's causing problems? Is it something else with the PCOS? Is one influencing the other? I'm not sure. And they're also saying that anemia may also be seen with hypothyroidism. And we know that anemia also impacts milk production. Are you all drowning with me yet?
Yeah.
Okay, good. You're not alone. So the question, does this mean that PCOS might cause breastfeeding problems for all affected women? Okay, I want to say no. There are a whole lot of women with PCOS who do make enough milk. And in fact, I was asked this question once, and I did a real quick casual study, and about two-thirds of the women told me that they made enough milk. One-third of them didn't make enough milk, and of that one-third, a small portion had severe problems, and the other portion had mild problems. So not every PCOS woman is going to be a milk supply problem, but it definitely seems to be higher risk. My thesis in what I did, my population, the way I approached this situation, is I enrolled women who had documented supply failure. I wasn't looking just at the PCO, but I was using PCO as my lens to understand everything. So I enrolled them, and if they had documented supply failure from other LCs, every place I could get a case, and I screened them for common factors. I looked at clinical symptoms, hormonal symptoms, family history, breast shape, breast size, veining, intramammary distance. All the things I found flagged in those other research articles, those were the things I was looking at for common factors. Just a brief on my results, just distribution of breast types. We were talking about the type 1, 2, 3, 4 from the Huggins model. And these are, a lot of these are self-reported. Some of them are reported by the LC, so they're not going to be 100% clean. But it's interesting that a quarter of the women said they had type 1. Look how many said type 2, almost half. Now, a lot of times we tend to think of milk supply problems in extremes, but there's this whole gray area. There's this whole ambiguous area of not bad looking, not bad enough for you to say, oh, that's obviously a problem. You kind of sit there and you look at it and you go, I don't know. Maybe it's an okay breast and maybe it isn't. And then the proportion of the more severe types was just a third of them. And then with the breast shapes from Ellen and Shelley's book, you can see 10 out of that 30 said they were saggy, that normal presentation, and another 8 in that upright. So a good 50% of them were reporting normal breasts, but then you've got 50% that fell into some of those other categories that are more red flag categories. Clinical symptom-wise, kind of jumped all over. Of this group of women, almost 50% had problems with hirsutism. Actually, I think that's pretty significant. Almost 50% of them had. And what is that indicative of? Androgens, yes. An adult acne, look at that, 50%. The acanthosis nigricans is more about 20%. And let's see, with skin tags up here, I don't see them up here. And the endometriosis, I was looking at that, didn't get a lot out of that. But obesity, over 50% of the women. Infertility, over 50%. Irregular cycles, that was almost 70%. That was a huge number. So in this group of women who had supply failure problems, look at how many issues they had going on, symptomatically, if we didn't have blood panel results. Breast growth-wise, I asked them, and then I rated their answers. Did they experience any breast growth during pregnancy or after pregnancy? 0 meant nothing happened. 1 is if they said, well, I kind of think they did, or she turned to her husband and said, did my breast change? If she couldn't tell me for sure. And then 2 was if she said, oh, yeah, you know, I had to get a new bra or anything like that. So you can see in pregnancy, 12, not quite half, but a good number of them had no changes. 8 of them had mild changes. Now, 10 of them thought that they had good changes, but you have to take that with a grain of salt. And then postpartum-wise, 18 of them said that something happened afterwards. 8 of them said a little bit, nothing happened, a little happened. Only 4 of them said that something, and that really makes sense, doesn't it? 4 out of the 30, if they had milk supply problems, they're not experiencing changes because, well, they have milk supply problems. So that makes sense. That's consistent, isn't it? Now, additional observations for the women were not diagnosed hypothyroid, yet they had a history of borderline low levels. And I had that question mark, can subclinical levels have an impact? Maybe we have the wrong threshold for what we call hypothyroid. Some women reported sensations of fullness that were reminiscent of engorgement. This was another aha for me because I had one of them sitting in my office, and she was telling me, you know, didn't have enough milk for her baby, but, you know, did your milk come in? She said, well, I think it came in today. I feel really, you know, I just feel really full. I saw her breasts, and I didn't see anything. She's telling me she felt full, and I saw these little breasts, and when I palpated, I felt this little walnut there. And then there was another aha for me. So maybe she had a small amount of breast tissue, but what small amount she had worked 100%. So what she had filled up and felt very tight to her. Does that make sense? But it wasn't nearly enough breast tissue to get the volume that a baby needed. So that I learned a lesson from that. When women say, oh yeah, my milk came in, I feel really tight, don't assume that everything is normal. Don't assume that that means that there's enough milk and enough breast tissue and all of that. The mother's perception of which day the milk came in, most often when they're telling me this, they were basing it on a volume increase. And so women who were looking for a volume increase, some of them said it never came in, or, you know, day 6 or 7, if they saw anything. But the color change, I think, is more accurate, because that's really what's happening. If the whole process is taking place, but we just don't have enough glandular tissue, you will see color change. In fact, if you don't see color change, I think that you almost want to look at the delayed first. Color of the, from colostrum to mature milk, I'm sorry. Going from that amber yellow to light yellow to the white creamy color. They're looking for that different, you know, some of them weren't looking at that. They're just telling me there's no fullness, therefore there's no milk, but then you can see it's white. So something did happen. There was an appropriate change. It just didn't go enough. Okay, so in my study, 43% of these women were officially diagnosed PCO, with 30% more likely. So that means about 70% of them were likely to be PCO. 50%, then, so I found that very significant. Now, this is not like a rock-solid study, because there was a lot of bias involved in the reporting and even in how the women were recruited. They were not recruited randomly, but at the same time, just to get anybody who had supply failure and to see what they had in common, I found that significant. The clear risk factors that I found were pregnancy, breast growth, and shape. Which agrees with Neifert and Huggins. It disagrees with Cox and Hartman. The intramammary space greater than 1.5 inches, that agreed with Huggins' findings. And the non-prominent veining, and I didn't mention this earlier, but your breasts normally, the veins normally grow during pregnancy when your breasts grow. And I found that it was a risk factor that if they did not have obvious veining in their breasts, that it was so it seemed to be a sign of inadequate growth. And that agreed with Huggins and Cox. Both noticed that. Now, I just want to make a quick comment reconciling the breast growth significance, because Cox and Hartman have talked about they found no relationship between milk production and breast volume or breast growth, but rather they found a relationship between milk production and storage capacity. We all had different populations. Okay, these are different studies, different populations of women and how they were recruited. And I want to say, is it possible that some women experience a growth in the gland that is balanced by a decrease in connective and fatty tissue, where there be no measurable difference on the outside, and yet you can and no measurable net change in volume? Does this make sense? Remember those two women, those Waller pictures? Two breasts look the same, and I wondered if it's possible that you can have changes that balance each other out that looks like there's nothing going on. You know, there's no change. I'm trying to understand what Cox has found and trying to reconcile it with some of our findings. Why do we find it a risk factor and he doesn't? And I really wonder if it's just a difference in the populations and the way we've studied them and what's going on inside the breast. Yeah, she's commenting his N was 8 and ours was 30. There's just lots of questions to be answered, you know? And I don't dismiss anybody's findings. It's like I want to understand how do these things all fit together. So there's a comment, while proliferation of breast tissue is necessary for sufficient milk production to sustain an infant, the breast does not need to be enlarged above preconception size to continue significant milk production. I think this is from Cox. And they say further studies are needed to identify the proportions of different tissues in the lactating and quiescent breast. So that goes along with what I was just saying. They're saying we need to look at that more too. Just some interesting observations. Breast growth, areolar growth, and breast volume are all influenced by the human placental lactogen. Nipple growth and the rate of excretion of lactose are related to the concentration of prolactin. So different aspects of lactation are related to prolactin and human placental lactogen. They have impact on nipple versus the areola versus the breast versus the lactose. And then the rate of breast growth is generally high until about 5 months during pregnancy. So the question that we get down to then is, what can be done for affected mothers? And I'm going to tell you right off the bat as we go into this, I don't have the cure-all for you. So if you're here for the cure-all, you're going to be a little disappointed, but I do have thoughts and ideas as I've been working along that I hope you'll go with me on. First of all, the dilemma for the current baby is that so far there's been a relative lack of success with our usual measures. Okay, pumping alone, just take one of these women, especially if they don't have a lot of glandular tissue, and pump the heck out of them, and you might get a little difference, but we're not getting our full supply out of her. Pharmaceutically, when we use Reglan and Domperidone, we get some effect, but it's not real great. Herbs, I've had marginal improvement. That here's a question mark for me. It might be due to inappropriate targeting or inadequate dosage amounts. You know, at least with Reglan and Domperidone, we have some idea of dosages, but with herbs, we are all over the map in terms of how we decide how much anybody needs in a given situation. Plus, there's a huge difference between when we have low supply because she wasn't nursing enough and it was a management issue, and when we have low supply due to something inside the breast, which comes to targeting. Is that herb even acting on anything that matters here to help correct what's wrong inside? We're really throwing darts at a wall when we're doing these things. I'm not saying not to do them, but just realize we really are throwing darts. We really don't know if we're getting at the problem or not. And Lawrence comments that except in extreme cases, hormone depletion is rarely the problem, but hormone release and target organ sensitivity are, which is a whole other issue. Changes in serum concentration have no effect if the receptors are not present. So what this is saying is you've got a mom and you can pump her full of prolactin, but if she doesn't have enough receptors, it just doesn't make a big difference. That's part of that targeting again. Confounding treatment variables. We don't know the endocrine imbalances. That woman with PCOS has a whole list of possible problems. Which one is it? We may have tests on her. We may not. So we're not even sure which thing could be the interference. With prolactin, there's no direct relationship between prolactin and milk levels, and yet it matters. You got to have it. We've never found a correlation. This much prolactin makes this much milk, and yet it still matters. And prolactin tests often reveal either perfectly normal or borderline levels for that time postpartum, and yet we've got poor supply. So what do we do if we say normal prolactin and we still have no milk? Now where do I go with that? And it can be due to all these other things. Thyroid treatment may not always be the cure. The testosterone issue, if we can bring that down, and you know, in Kay Hoover's case, when they brought it down, that made a difference. And do we need to suppress testosterone in some women? That's something we even looked at with PCO. With Huggins, now here's another aspect. She did show that continued pumping resulted in a gradual increase in milk supply in many mothers. It could take, and actually I have 3 months here, but I think she said 1 month later when I talked with her, because it can take weeks before you know the result of the pumping, whether it's going to work.
But testosterone levels were falling. It could have been
like, it was increasing. Okay, in cases?
Well, I mean, even in
if it's a thecaludian cyst, yes. But in the other cases, when the high androgen levels are not connected to the pregnancy, that would be a different situation. Spiroff talks about mild deficiencies, and this is interesting. Mild deficiencies in estrogen, progesterone, thyroxine, cortisol, insulin, prolactin, growth hormone can be compensated for by excess prolactin. So what I hear from Spiroff is that if we have some mild problems with some of these other hormones, if we still pump her with prolactin, so say we give her Reglan and we push prolactin, sometimes just that extra prolactin can help compensate for those mild deficiencies of those other things. So this does give some legitimacy to the therapies that are increasing prolactin levels. Okay, mild deficiencies may be compensated for. With a special case of PCOS, we've got multiple problems that make it difficult to determine the target and the cause. We know about the prolactin levels, the thyroid deficiencies. Here's a good quote from Contreras. The prolactin response to metoclopramide in women with spontaneous thyroid disease was significantly smaller than in controls. So they're saying that women who had a spontaneous disease, when they gave them metoclopramide, they didn't get the same response out of the prolactin as a normal woman would. This is just kind of why these therapies may or may not work in this situation. And then testosterone levels. The serum levels don't always reflect clinical symptoms. She can have all kinds of body hair, and the test and her lab results can come back and say normal. And you're going, well, there's got to be something wrong here, right? The progesterone, if it's deficient for breast growth, we can't go back and redo that, can we? Because progesterone given in the postpartum period is going to interfere with lactation. Think of birth control pills and things like that. So if the progesterone deficiency was the issue, that's something we just cannot go back and rework. So you got to look at the big picture. Okay, start with a good maternal health history, including any medical conditions, allergies, history of depression, current medications. History of depression is in bold for an important reason. We want to know, what is the basic problem? Is there a lactogenic medication or herb that seems to target this issue? So, for instance, women with PCOS, sometimes they will try and treat the hyperandrogenism with saw palmetto. They'll try and treat the irregularities with Vitex. Interestingly, Vitex is considered by some people to be a galactagogue. Now, that is the information runs both directions. I've not gotten any good conclusions out of that. But do we have an herb that maybe is considered galactagogue that also seems to apply to this issue? You know, let's connect some dots and try and put these together. What is the mother's comfort and philosophy regarding medication and herbs? Some women don't want anything to do with either of these. It's pumping or nothing, so that might be the only tool we get to work with. Some will go with herbs and not medications. Some will go with medications and not herbs. So we have to work within her philosophy before we can even go after this. Then probably the biggest issue of all, are there institutional or health care provider restrictions on what can be used? If you're hospital-based, you may not be allowed to use the word herbs. Yeah, that might not be a possibility at all. So we have to work very carefully within the framework of the mother's health care providers when we're trying to devise a plan for this whole problem. Now, in your syllabus, you should have this form. It's something that I developed really as a checklist for myself because there are so many things I couldn't remember them all off the top of my head. You're taking a health history and trying to remember asking everything, and I sure couldn't, so I kind of wrote this all down, and I hope you find it helpful. It goes through secondary factors and then primary factors, all the things that you can think about and look for. Breast types. Anybody who has not seen this and hasn't read Huggins' article is not going to understand what this is all about, but you guys do. And then here I also developed an algorithm to predict PCOS or hormonal type of problems. The galactagogues of choice for PCOS, herbal-wise, Gotu is one that I'm really intrigued with. It may have possibly have a similar action metformin. Gotu is actually the precursor to what the precursor of metformin was based on. It was developed from Gotu, and it works on insulin resistance. And so Gotu also has a reputation of being a galactagogue and increasing breast production, breast tissue. So if you're going to choose an herb, doesn't that sound like a real good candidate? In terms of targeting, something that kind of crosses over into both issues. And you know what, I would love to answer, but I'm going to probably be late, so can we just hold it to the end? Hang on to that. I apologize, we got a late start. Fenugreek is also reputed to increase breast tissue. It's also a hypoglycemic. You do need to check for a history of hypoglycemia when you use fenugreek or Gotu. If somebody is real prone to hypoglycemia, it might not be a good idea for them to use these. Vitex and Chasteberry has been used to treat PCOS because of the reputation for balancing the hormones. It could act indirectly as a galactagogue, not directly but indirectly, but I haven't had a chance to work with it enough and nobody else has, so I can't give you any concrete things on that. Pharmaceutically, Reglan, special caution. Women with PCOS appear to be more prone to depression, and Reglan has the potential to induce depression. I've probably seen it 5 to 10 times now. So I don't like my women with PCOS using Reglan. I just think it's a bad, bad idea. Domperidone is a much better choice pharmaceutically. You know, a woman who got depression on domperidone, are you sure they're connected? Because it doesn't penetrate the blood-brain barrier.
I know, but if the depression went away, would you stop it?
Huh. Talk to Tom Hill about that. I'd love to hear what he'd have to say. I really would. Metformin, which is used to treat PCOS, it's a type 2 anti-diabetes medication that deals with insulin resistance. It has the potential to correct multiple unknown imbalances. The best potential is when there's moderate breast development already in place. I've had a couple cases now. There have been actually probably 4, 5, 6 cases of women who have had poor milk supply but didn't have real bad breasts, and when they were put on metformin, the milk supply came up. It improves insulin resistance. It doesn't act directly, so it's not an issue for the baby. Tom Hale studied it. I have that next. He studied 5 milk samples, and basically he's going to be changing his rating in the next book from L3 to L2, which is really good. So even though the information out there seems to suggest that a mother should not take it while breastfeeding, actually it's going to be fine. And this may help the mother's health as well as her milk supply if the breast development is decently in place. And that's just a picture of from his study. Just a couple quick case studies with metformin. With one of my first case mothers, we researched it. We started her on metformin at approximately 2 months postpartum. Interestingly, she reported that she felt her milk supply just starting to come up until she got pregnant. This is a woman who could never get pregnant when she wanted to and just would happen every once in a while. Got pregnant 2 months postpartum right after starting metformin. So that was the end of that little experiment. Another mom who was at a conference that I spoke at a year ago, she was para 3, she's an IBCLC, had not been diagnosed PCOS until after she recognized her symptoms during the presentation I was giving. She had already experimented positively with Vitex, so she was self-treating. She now added metformin, decreased her Vitex and domperidone. She noticed an increase in baby's diaper output after a month of therapy. And this is a tough situation because the baby's like 6 months of age, so we're really far down the line, but it still seemed to be making a difference for her. There are 2 PCOS moms who had low supply who were prescribed metformin by their doctors, or doctors LC. One mother's output doubled, and the other came up dramatically. There's a mom of a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old started back on metformin after experiencing a weight gain. So she'd been taken off of her medications, to have her baby. But then, she has a baby, she's nursing, starts putting on the weight, goes back to the doctor, and says, "Let's start you back on your glucophage again." And because of the rebound of her PCOS symptoms. After 3 days of 1,000 milligrams and upping it to 1,500 milligrams, this is what she wrote: "All day my breasts have been very full and my son has been gorging himself silly. The med is the only thing that has changed, and it seems that my volume has gone way up." She had struggled with borderline milk supply for 3 babies, and just kind of never saw a connection. Was not doing the metformin because of milk supply, but because of health. But lo and behold, look what happened. So there have been some very encouraging things that have happened. Now, my other question mark is, what about future babies? Because I think there's a whole other issue here to look at. What about those women who didn't develop enough breast tissue? What can we do about that? Interestingly, Stein in 1944 commented on one case of a woman who had primary amenorrhea. She didn't have almost no breast development. And once he did a wedge resection to treat the PCO, she then went on to develop breast tissue and to breastfeed. She got pregnant normally and breastfed normally. This woman had nothing until after she had that correction. And so that gives me a little bit of hope that maybe some of these situations that we thought, remember we were talking about, is it genetic, which implies permanent, or is it hormonal? Maybe some of these things are changeable.
What is ovarian function?
That is a surgical technique where they, and I can't, I really am not good at describing exactly what it is, but they cut into the ovary. Now, if you haven't seen this case, Bobby and Powers in 1999, this was one of those huge ahas also, luteal phase insufficiency case. And what happened, I didn't mean to go there yet. But in their particular case, they had a woman who had, with her first baby, she was diagnosed with insufficient mammary tissue, insufficient milk production. You know, everything looked awful. She went on to have another baby, and when she was trying to get pregnant, she experienced secondary infertility. They diagnosed her with luteal phase insufficiency, treated her with progesterone before and during the pregnancy. She grew full breast tissue that pregnancy and went on to fully lactate. And this is a woman who had been diagnosed with insufficient mammary tissue the baby before. So there's another blow-your-mind case where you think, oh, this is the way it's always going to be, but it changed. Something changed. So there seemed to be some evidence in some of these situations, maybe not for the current baby, maybe we can't fix it, but maybe for the next baby we can work on it. We have this question of breast growth windows. In gynecomastia, the question is, when that's huge overgrowth of breast tissue, they think it might be due to a sensitivity to prolactin. So again, could undersensitivity be the issue? And then in cancer gene cell research, they're trying to close growth windows. And as they're trying to learn how to do this, we may be able to learn how to reopen them. I talked with one researcher who said he feels we may be just a couple years away from learning how to reopen that. So even though she may be past her teen years when the breasts are supposed to grow, we may be able to do that again, open it and allow that growth to take place. I see some promising things on the horizon. The potential relationships between obesity and diabetes and PCOS and hypoplasia, the treatments such as metformin may correct underlying problems. So I want to see these women get treated before they have their next baby. Maybe if they get good treatment, whether it's the low-carbing, the metformin or whatever, maybe if their body is healthier and hormones begin to balance, maybe things will develop more normally for the next pregnancy. And I have heard of variations from one baby to the next in terms of what has happened.
So you mean to say metformin wild
pregnant? Yes.
Baby, so.
No. And I think, latest research shows that metformin through the first trimester reduces miscarriage rates from 65 to 15% and the risk of gestational diabetes from 40 and 29% down to 3%. Some very impressive preliminary statistics in terms of if we're afraid if it's going to be a problem for the pregnancy, well, it seems to be holding on to babies. And there's also this question of progesterone supplement. This is kind of out there, but Katharina Dalton talked about using progesterone cream on the breast and things like that, and she swears that mothers made more milk, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, progesterone and breast development. I don't know if there's any credence to that, but I've been intrigued with the idea. And then red raspberry leaf tea, I've been told, has helped to promote progesterone also. Now, this is a mom who did everything right. She had metformin treatment before and during her pregnancy. She had progesterone treatment. She had a good start to breastfeeding, but she only had drops of milk, even with Galactagog. She chose not to do the prescriptive ones. So this is one of those things I say, not always successful. Here's somebody who did everything I could have asked before and during and after, but you can see that she didn't have much breast tissue. And whatever it was that needed to change, we weren't able to change. I've had a mom who was in my study who came back and said, guess what, I had another baby and I made a whole bunch more milk, and she told me about this lactation brew that she did. She had this, during pregnancy, she had this tea of red raspberry leaf, nettle, alfalfa, and clover, which are all known galactagogues, and then she added afterwards hops, blessed thistle, marshmallow root, fenugreek, and goat's root powder. And she said she and another friend, both who were involved in my study, both made, I'm not sure they got the full supplies, but a lot more milk the second time around. So this is sort of their self-treatment. And I'm intrigued with what people find to do to change the outcome the next time around. And this is my last case here. This mom is fascinating to me. She had type 2 breasts. She was making less than 30 cc's every 2 to 3 hours. Her baby was drying out and not getting enough. The midwife described the breasts as, she thought they were really bad. She described them as dog ears. I would call them type 2, not nearly as bad as she thought. The mom is a staunch vegan, did not want to do medications. They really didn't want to do formula there. And so they were highly motivated. So she started on More Milk Plus and Goat's Root. And the initial induction on the instructions say you can take them as often as every hour or so until things get better, and then you back off. So she started doing it basically every time she breastfed, which is about every 2 hours. But she didn't stop doing that. She did that for weeks. That was not my instructions. That's what she did. She experienced enhanced breast growth. She then, more recently, she added mother's milk and raspberry leaf tea, plus she started eating. She's doing everything she could think of. But interestingly, at the six-week appointment, we documented an intake of 104 cc's. I about fell off my chair. You know, for 3 or 4 weeks, I was seeing 30 or less cc's no matter what. We were supplementing with formula, and all of a sudden, she went up to what I would say about 95% supply. She did something different than all the other mothers I've had try go through. She used that, and the more milk, she used them extremely aggressively. There is no, nobody has recommended that. That's just what she did. And I thought, you remember I was talking about maybe we don't have adequate dosages because nobody studied this? Well, here's somebody who did it aggressively, and I was just amazed. Here she is. Look at the significant veining and breast growth after several weeks of the goat's through and the more milk plus. I have it right up here. It's by Mother Love Herbal. It's a tincture. It's a combination of fenugreek and blessed thistle, nettles, alfalfa, I think. And then here, look at her breasts are now really heavy with milk. And that has just been one thrilling, really positive outcome for me. Very encouraging to keep pursuing that direction. And we're not too bad here. So just in conclusion, we're just starting to understand the web-like complexities. I had this picture of a spider web because do you get that feeling? Did you just get tangled? Okay. It really has that feel to it. We're really just starting to explore and understand all these complexities. We need a lot more research, and if there's those of you out there who have particular expertise, I hope you grab the ball and run, because nobody has enough knowledge. Not one person has all the answers. We need to pull together. There's lots that need to be done. I want to thank you for your attention today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you'd like individually up here.